Hey, would you like to buy a monkey?
Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel this morning. I'm Joe Donahue along with WAMC's newsman Ray Graff. Good morning, Raymond.
Good morning, sir.
And animal writer and journalist Elizabeth Hess is with us. She is the author of the bestseller Nim Chimpsky, which is the basis for the award-winning documentary Project Nim. And it's a great pleasure to have you with us this morning.
Happy to be here.
Thank you very much for being with us. We're going to talk a lot about primates and simians and monkeys today. And
this thrills you, doesn't it?
Well, it does.
It really does.
We've been working on this for a long time, and I'm thrilled. We later on in the program we'll have Franz De Waal and Jane Goodall. We're going to hear an amazing story from a woman by the name of Marina Chapman, who spent 5 years of her youth growing up with capuchin monkeys. And I'm thrilled to have Elizabeth in the studio because she has done so much on the subject of primatology and looking at this particular study that was done with Nim Chimpsky. How did you first come to that as a subject?
Well, I didn't quite know what I was getting into, which is why I think I leapt right in. But I was looking for an animal to write a biography of, and I was looking for a worthy animal. I felt that people didn't understand that animals could be looked at and treated as individuals, that they had real lives, just like we do, with a beginning, a middle, and end. And I didn't want it to be a dog or a cat because I thought, you know, that's too easy.
Yeah.
And so I was looking at elephants and parrots, and then Nim died.
Yeah. And in 2000, right?
In 2000. And I read his obituary in the Times. And I thought, you know, what kind of animal gets an obituary in the New York Times? And I just had never heard the story. So it piqued my interest. And the minute I started researching Nim's life, I realized he had a story that never had been told. For many reasons, the scientific community had swept it under the rug, and the people who had been around him just didn't want to talk about it.
This is a chimp that was born in the early 1970s, 1973. And the idea of the scientific study all along, this came out of Columbia, correct?
Yes.
And the idea all along was to consider language skills, hence Noam Chomsky, Nim Chimpsky, and you would take Nim and put him into a family, allow him to grow up in a family, and see what language would develop, right?
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. The notion was if, you know, Herbert Terrace argued that the chimpanzee could acquire language in the same way that the human child could. And that if you put the chimp in at birth in a human family and just let him absorb the atmosphere, you know, eat the furniture, learn the words from the other kids, that chimp would acquire language just like the other infants. And Chomsky is the one who said, you got to be crazy. Language is language. There's a genetic, very deep ability that humans have, and it's exclusive to humans.
Humans are wired that way.
To acquire language, exactly.
And the chimps would not be.
And Terrace, who was a behaviorist at the time, was going to prove Chomsky wrong. And Terrace was Skinner's protege, and there had always been a battle between Skinner and Chomsky. So the politics of this were very, you know, heavily watched.
One of the things that I found fascinating about the study, and I just have to ask you about this because you get the sense in your book and you get the sense in the documentary as well, because it's said in the documentary a few times, which is there are just some odd things that happen of how all this comes to be of the chimp moving into the house and what is being done and the chimp is smoking pot and
what?
And at different times they just look at the camera
and cigarettes.
And cigarettes, and they just look at the camera and they say, "Well, it was the '70s."
Ah.
Right. Well, it was the 70s.
All the chimps were doing it back
yeah.
then.
Yeah,
that's right.
It was the 70s. And I mean, much of the story is that this scientist who you mentioned, Herbert Terrace, the woman who originally took in Nim was a student of his. They had had a relationship. And then another woman who he had had a relationship then took on the role. So, I mean, there was a lot going on there that was kind of strange that perhaps was aside from the quote-unquote science, right?
Quote-unquote science is a good way to put it. I think actually these kinds of affairs between scientists and students probably happen all the time. And at that point, it was not illegal to have an affair with your professor, which, of course, it would be now. But it was a very small project. No one had ever done anything like this before.
Gives monkey business a whole new
hey, no.
kind of
thing. All right.
Go ahead. I'm
sorry.
It
does. And the chimp was, because he had been snatched away from his mother and father 10 days after birth and thrown in this family, he really had bonded to his human family. I mean, who knows what that means to a chimp, whether he thought he was a human, thought he was a chimp, thought he would eventually grow hair all over his face, just like all the people, I mean, lose all the hair on his face.
Yeah.
It's hard to say what he was thinking, but he did learn. Chimps don't have voice boxes, so they chose American Sign Language and began teaching him as if he were a little boy. And they found that he acquired signs very fluidly. It's a language that chimps like.
And they could understand very simple, simple and then somewhat more complex commands.
This is the question,
right? And you use man bites dog as the example, right? Of how we think of dog bites man bites dog of okay, you understand the word, but do you understand the relationship
concept.
And the concept?
Yeah, I mean, Nim certainly understood the concept of biting, and bit a number of people,
mostly men.
No, he bit some of his female caretakers too. If he wanted to fire them, he bit them, and they went running.
Okay.
One of the reasons the project was closed down far too fast is because the thought was that the lawsuits were going to mount, students were getting hurt, and that nobody could control him. And again, this was the mid-70s. We didn't know too much about chimpanzees. Jane Goodall hadn't written all her books yet. Jane Goodall was not brought in, which she could have been,
yeah.
to help. There weren't any chimp experts around, and there weren't even really any ASL experts around. Eventually, they did get some real people who ASL was their native language, and there was the feeling that those people could communicate more easily to Nim.
ASL being American Sign Language,
yeah.
and this was a recognized that the trainers were using that around the chimp at all times, hoping that he would pick it up and that they could also teach him as well.
Yeah, I mean, they charted very, very carefully. Every time he got a word, it went up on the chart and everybody was thrilled, and he had to use it five times and use it three different ways, and there was all this stuff. But on the other hand, you know, as you know, because you have a dog, you often communicate with that animal through body language, through your eyes. I mean, there's all kinds of
yeah.
ways to... So communication with Nim was not a problem. And if you ask anyone who was around him at that time whether you could use... whether he understood your sign language, whether or not, you know, you really could communicate with him, every person I spoke with, and there were hundreds, all said yes, absolutely.
Mm.
And because he had the ASL, it gave him a kind of... You know, he tuned right into people because he could get their attention, and he could, you know, what it was simple. Maybe he wanted a drink, but he also knew how to communicate more, and he hung out with them, and he could get to do what he wanted to do through communication. I mean, it was very interesting. It was not like a dog. It was like, you know, a dog times eight. You know, it was like a very brilliant animal.
Elizabeth Hess is our panel guest this morning. I'm here with Ray Graff, and we are talking about chimps. We're talking about primates and simians, and in this particular case, talking about Elizabeth's work with Nim Chimpsky, which is the name of her book as well. A documentary based on the book, which was released 2 years ago, called Project Nim, is also a wonderful thing to see that was put out by the BBC. We're going to continue our conversation when we come back. We'll go over a little bit of a timeline and then some of the issues that developed. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Harry King Rug and Home, East Hampton, Massachusetts, offering antique reproduction, modern and tribal area rugs made from vegetable dyes, rug cleaning and repair, harryking.com. Harney & Sons Fine Teas, Millerton, New York, featuring over 200 different teas, celebrating Mother's Day, with brunch at their tasting room and Mother's Day gift assortments available online, harney.com. And Bard College Master of Arts in Teaching Program, offering a one-year master's degree and teaching certification, scholarships and part-time available, teaching what matters, bard.edu/MAT.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue, along with WAMC's Ray Graff and writer and journalist Elizabeth Hess, author of the bestseller Nim Chimpsky. One of the things that I find interesting about this story is when we talk about when you think of this as a study, give us a bit of a timeline of how long this went on for.
Well, Nim was born in 1973, and he came. That's the year he came to New York. And Terrace's project only—
Living in Manhattan, by the way, in a brownstone.
In a beautiful brownstone on the Upper West Side with a family named the Lafarge. It was a blended family, a recent divorce, and there were five children, and of, you know, ages— lower school through high school. So some of them loved having him around. Some of them hated having him around. And it was the Weir Lafarge was a fairly well-known poet. Stephanie Lafarge was a psychologist, and she was going to use Nim for her thesis at Columbia. And in many ways, those first 2 years were probably the best 2 years of Nim's life. He had a lot of freedom. He had kids to play with who were his own age. He had a dog who was his best buddy. He was taken to the country on weekends.
Right.
And
you say that comparatively to—
Comparatively.
—of what it would have been had they just left the poor thing alone.
Yes, that would have been better, although Nim was born in captivity.
Right.
So he had to escape that cage somehow.
Yeah. So 2 years, and then Nim went.
Then he went to this house called Delafield, which was on the Columbia campus. Terrace felt he didn't have enough control over him in the home. Nim's mother was sort of going to war with Terrace over the quality of care that she wanted Nim to get. I mean, there are lots of problematic issues. So Terrace kind of yanked him away, put him in this house, this beautiful mansion in Riverdale, and he was there for another 2 years with a whole bunch of students living with him. And that's the point where he started to develop lots of anxiety about transitions. As children, human children
kids do. Sure.
And because it was like, you know, one person would have him for 2 hours, the next person would have him for 3 hours. It was a patchwork quilt of people. And Nim made very deep attachments to people. And he wanted the same people to be there, and then they would go. And he was becoming more difficult, although he was still acquiring words week by week by week. And his vocabulary, I think, by the end of the next 2 years was about 150 words. And that's when Terrace said, it's getting too hard. People are getting bitten. I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. And I'm going to get rid of the chimp and just sit and analyze my data for a while. And the staff, you know, pretty much tried to rebel against that decision.
And eventually they give up Nim.
Back to Oklahoma, where he was born.
In a lab setting.
In a lab setting. But that nobody knew how precarious that lab in Oklahoma, the Primate Institute, really was. And within another year, within 2 years, it was starting to go belly up. They had no money. So Lemon started selling off all the chimps to medical research. And that was the only way he supported his own research, which was into breeding and issues of birth and female sexuality in chimps. He was sort of the Masters and Johnsons of chimp sexuality. He did some strange and unpublished studies. But when he went really broke and he was becoming ill, Nim and the whole group of chimps, Roger Fouts had been in Oklahoma, by the way, a quick aside, teaching students, you could take a language course with chimps there. And Roger was out signing with all the chimps at the Institute. So there was a whole group of chimps who signed to each other and who knew each other. And they had been born there, so they were related and they had sort of grown up with each other and then been returned. All those chimps were sold to LEMSIP, which was NYU's hepatitis study. And these are chimps that had been primarily in behavior research, or they had been living with human families and then returned. And suddenly they end up at NYU in these small cages about the size of a refrigerator box, about to go into the first hepatitis studies. And that's when the media became involved, because there were some very serious ethical issues. I mean, can you take this little chimp, Nim, and try and convince him that he's a human and that he should be speaking a human language, that he has human siblings, and then when the scientist says it's over, throw him in a cage for the next study down the line?
And there's so many sad, heartbreaking moments to the story. I mean, beginning with just sort of the removal of the little baby from its mother, and then, which is wrenching, and then just this sort of stop and start, oh, we care about you, now we don't, eras of the chimp's life, right?
Yes.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue with Elizabeth Hess and talk about many of the issues, of course, about research and about chimps in labs and federal labs, and even the fact that Harvard has just closed down their primate lab. We'll talk about this and much more after a news break. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to our roundtable panel. Ray Graff is here, as well as writer and journalist Elizabeth Hess, author of the bestseller Nim Chimpsky. We're talking a lot about chimpanzees this morning, as well as primates and simians, and it's a great pleasure to have Elizabeth Hess with us. Give us a sense of... Nim died at the age of 26 of a heart attack. In a chimp's normal lifespan, is that a young age to pass?
Yes, that's a very young age, and they live into their 40s, sometimes in their 50s. He had an enlarged heart, and they were watching it. His brother died at exactly the same age of exactly the same thing, so it may have been running in the family. But he dropped dead in his cage, and... he had just signed for a morning snack. He was waiting for his mangoes and bananas eagerly. And the caregiver came in back to the cage, and he was lying on the floor. And his friend Kitty was on top of him, refusing to let anyone near him. And chimps mourn for their buddies when they die. It was very tragic, and he was alone. So after that.
How was, and Ray asked this question during the break, but how did he live out the last years of his life?
Well, the last years of his life, he was in Texas at the Black Beauty Ranch, which was founded by Cleveland Amory. And he was the first primate there. No, actually, they had some, I think they had, may have had some monkeys, but he was certainly the first chimp. And chimps are really hard keepers. And Nim's nickname was Houdini. And he could pick any lock. He could get out of any window. He was absolutely amazing at this. So he had many what they called jailbreaks. And they were terrified that, you know, he was going to break out of his cage and run off into the woods and they would never see him again.
Yeah.
But in fact, he broke out of his cage and he would go right to the director's house. He would get into bed. He would turn on the TV. He would raid the refrigerator and go through the closet and get out all the shoes. He loved shoes.
Wow.
And then they would walk him back to his cage.
Cleveland Amory was a wonderful writer. He was I think it's safe to say he was an animal rights activist as well. He I think his later life was probably best known for the Cat and the Curmudgeon and these books that he wrote about his cats. And was I think one of the youngest editors of the Saturday Evening Post. Even he'd had a wonderful journalistic career, and he was really the one who came in and saved the day.
He is, and he comes from a renowned line of animal rescue, Humane Society people. He had a relative who founded the Massachusetts Humane Society, and, you know, this was sort of in his blood, so to speak, and he was very committed, and he did these rescues that were, like, phenomenal. I mean, there are all these burrows in the Grand Canyon, and he got some helicopter guys to build a special sling, and they went in, and the guys at the bottom would wrap the burrows into slings, and he hauled them out one by one. It took days, and he rescued all of them, and that's how Black Beauty Ranch was initially founded, for those burrows, because the rangers were just shooting them at the bottom because they were nuisances.
How did so? I guess now is the time to discuss what we got out of this. As far as you mentioned this very early in our conversation about how this study is still being debated today, and you also make the point that this study could not be done today because it would be considered cruel,
unethical. Yeah,
unethical. So, what did we learn anything from it?
Well, I think,
other than, you know, it was perhaps a bad idea.
Well, that's important.
Yeah.
That it was a bad idea.
Check
because most scientists get rewarded for good ideas. But, you know, I think we learned that you can't use these live animals in any way you want and call it science. And that there's so much research now showing that these are sensitive, cognitively intelligent, communicative creatures. And they're so much like us, it is frightening. And it's not just the DNA, it's when you look into their eyes.
Yeah.
And they do like to communicate with us. I mean, and they will. And so how do you take these creatures and make them sit in the cage for their entire lifespan, you know, getting a liver biopsy every month? It's tricky, and it doesn't work anymore. And the chimps, the last generation of wild-caught chimps who are now in their 40s and 50s are still alive in the labs. And the people who really know these animals are trying to get them out first because they've never been uncaged and on grass and all of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, now that the NIH has made it clear, it's illegal to breed chimpanzees for the purpose of research. And now the last 1,000, they may keep 50 of them, are going to be retired to sanctuary because all the research proves that the science that these animals are being used for doesn't work.
Yeah.
So, you know, why keep them anymore? I mean, there are 1,000 chimpanzees. There are hundreds of thousands of monkeys, and that's a whole other issue for science to deal with, whether or not those monkeys are necessary, too.
So there's this whole difference between behavior research and medical research. I mean, because we think of research, either way, the life of that animal is going to be altered.
Yes, and I think it's really a good point, because people think that medical invasive research is the most cruel and that that should stop if they're doing, you know, shots or heart surgery or brain probes. But it's also true that the behavioral research is really for life. I mean, in one sense, you get the liver biopsy and it's over. But NIMS, for instance, you know, NIMS behavioral issues were for life. And these studies that people do, some of them are very cruel, you know, babies that are taken away from their mothers to so that we can test the notion of whether babies need their mothers, stuff like that. But these animals are scarred for life, and zoos don't want them because they're too difficult, and you can't put them back in the wild. And, you know, I would argue that the behavioral studies are often just as cruel and can last, the effects can last even longer.
Well, I mean, if you're having a liver biopsy once a week and then they put you back in a cage, you're still scarred if they finally send you to a sanctuary. I mean, you've been in a cage your entire life.
And that's the problem, the cage. And if we argued that certain amount of research was necessary, the question would be, how would you house the animals? Would you allow them to be? I mean, these are very, very social animals, and they're all kept in isolation. And that's the biggest problem. It's like prisoners being kept in isolation. Yeah. You go crazy.
What do you think it is about monkeys and gorillas and chimpanzees, these primates, the simians, that we find so fascinating? I mean, ultimately, it's because they're like the most like us, right?
I think so.
So we see ourselves in them, and we want to know more.
But I think we haven't been taught a sort of basic respect for these creatures. And I think Jane Goodall is really working hard to do that. Otherwise, we would not see them as, you know, lab rats. And, you know, they are very cute, especially when they're babies. And a lot of people are attracted to monkeys as pets. There's breeders all over different states, especially in Florida, who are breeding pet monkeys for people. And, you know, by the time they're one, they've bitten someone badly in the face and, you know, nobody knows what to do with them. And I think we have to, you know, it's an education problem. You know, we have to learn about these wild animals. They're becoming extinct, first of all. I mean, you know, with global warming and jungles disappearing, they're not even going to be around that much longer. And I think we have to be taught some respect for them and not just see them. We see everything as potentially for the benefit of humankind. And I don't think that notion has served us very well.
With the NIH no longer funding this invasive medical research, So what other research is being done with these chimps, and how do we know the number of chimps that are being used for other research?
Well, it's a tricky question. We know, and the public only has access essentially to the chimps that are in federal labs.
Right.
I mean, there could be pharmaceutical companies that have their own chimpanzees. There could be you know, we farm some studies out of the country because it's cheaper to do blood work on chimps in China versus to do it here.
And what may be illegal here would be legal there.
Yeah. I mean, it's still a big mess, and there's still a lot of work to do. And, you know, I'm not proud of the fact that we're the last country in the world to make this research illegal on these animals. But it's a beginning. And the people, there's some really good organizations who are tracking all of this. I'm proud that they were able to use Project NIM to screen it for members of Congress when this Great Ape Protection and Cost-Saving Bill was going through, which is the bill that all these scientists convened and convinced the NIH to stop funding invasive medical research on chimps. You know, I think that once we begin to see who these animals are, it's both daunting and fascinating. And, you know, there are no chimpanzees in New York City at any of the five zoos. They're hard to see. It's hard to get to know them. So, you know, how do you do that? I think that's a good question to ask. I think sanctuaries have to bring it, you know, kids in and give them access to see some of these animals so they can learn, you know, what's right for them and what isn't.
Why are there none in New York?
Because zookeepers don't like chimpanzees. They're very intense and very intelligent, and they need a lot of what we call enrichment in zoos. And, you know,
it's not just feeding, watering, and moving.
So it's an expensive proposition.
They need their minds worked, or they go crazy. Gorillas, kind of the cows of the jungle, much calmer. And they don't take as much attention. Mm. So there's a lot of gorillas. There's the big gorilla thing at the Bronx Zoo.
Right. When we mentioned Harvard, but the New England Primate Research Center, this was really one of the top centers, right?
Well, it had a number of violations, and it was Harvard. And it's one of the oldest centers.
Labs.
And so therefore it had tremendous prestige. So the fact that they're closing it down is, I think, very significant because, you know, they didn't wait until it was closed down. They're closing it down. And it's monkeys. It's not chimpanzees. And, you know, everybody is starting to understand that you do not need these animals to do the research. There's a lot of labs are just using tissue samples now. A lot of labs are using rodents. They just found a strand of hepatitis C in field mice. I think they're ordinary field mice. They've been keeping chimps for potential new hepatitis vaccine. Now they're realizing they can probably do the same work on mice. I mean, I'm going to have to write a book about mice and rats next.
Yeah.
But, you know, chimpanzees are very expensive to keep, and they're such unhappy, difficult creatures. I can see how any facility could certainly make mice and rats a lot more content.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up our conversation with Elizabeth Hess, author of the bestseller Nim Chimpsky, and which was the basis for the wonderful documentary Project Nim. Ray Graff is here as well. We welcome your thoughts. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after the short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Handmade and More, New Paltz, jewelry and fashion accessories from American and regional designers for Mother's Day gifts, gift wrapping and cards, 845-255-6277, and on Facebook. The Gideon Putnam Resort, featuring on-site dining, the Roosevelt Baths and Spa, summer packages and more, gideonputnam.com. And Saratoga Health and Wellness, providing a 12-week weight loss program run by nutritionists and exercise physiologists, saratogahealthandwellness.com.
Dabba dabba dab in monkey talk means chimp, I love you too. Then the big baboon one night in June, he married them and very soon they went upon their abba dabba honeymoon.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Ray Graff is here, and we are joined by Elizabeth Hess, who is author of the bestseller Nim Chimpsky. And you made a point earlier, and I think it was off the air, and I just want to make sure that you make it on the air because I thought it was a great one, which is so much of the research that we have done, that we did in the past, was to find out how these animals are like us. And now we're more interested in finding out about the animal, which is where it should be, right?
Yes. I mean, especially with language studies, I mean, we're really interested in how chimps communicate with each other, as opposed to, you know, if you want to learn about the history of human language, people are studying babies. They're actually studying babbling and looking at the evolution of babbling into words. You don't sit around and study chimps for years and years and then say, God, how does that relate to us?
Yeah.
You just don't. I mean, it sounds obvious now, but at the time it wasn't. But it's really all changing.
Franz de Waal is going to be on our program a little bit later on. He has written a new book called The Bonobo and the Atheist, which may be one of the best titles of a book that we've ever had on the program. And and he is thought of as one of the good guys when it comes to this research.
Yes, he's probably the most prominent primatologist in the country, and he's extremely influential. And there were language studies done with bonobos by a researcher named Sue Savage Rumbau. And she has the most sophisticated language colony of primates who are alive today. She's still working with them. It's privately funded so she can keep them and do what she wants with them.
And within limits, right? There are certain limits even for private study, yes?
Yes. I mean, she there are limits, but she... I mean, I saw her while she was still at Emory, and she had the most beautiful enclosure for these kinds of animals that I had ever seen. And there was even a juice bar, and the bonobos could go up to the juice bar and they could order, you know, a strawberry shake with or without ice, and they knew how to do that. And they had cards, you know, so they could tap out their words. So there was no misunderstanding. I can't read that sign.
Right.
You know, before you went into their closure, she would ask Kanzi, this is Elizabeth Hess, she's come from New York, do you want to let her in? And she would wait for Kanzi to say, well, okay, let her in. I mean, there'd still be bars. But
yeah.
It was the communication. I mean, bonobos, they're very similar to chimpanzees. They're a little smaller and they're more upright. But they're extremely communicative. And for people like me going in to see them, and they all sort of rush you and they want to communicate with you, you know, you really get the sense of what they feel like, because I had no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And that must be how they feel all the time around these humans.
Well, it sounds like we could get them for interns here. I mean, you know, might have a little more success.
There you go, Ray.
He's going to be in
trouble.
You
work on that. That'll be
okay,
your project.
That'll be my project.
All right, we'll put you on that.
Fine.
We're also going to be speaking to a woman. I recorded this interview about a week ago with Marina Chapman, who has written a fascinating book about she grew up in Colombia, and she was abducted from her home and was like half drugged and left into the woods at 4 years old, and wandered into this group of capuchin monkeys who she lived with for 5 years before she was found. I'd love to tell you that the story got better after that, but it really didn't.
No.
But we learn from her about what it is like, and this is very much a Tarzan story, I think. And I know you read the book too, and I'm just curious as to what your thoughts were, because I mean, some of it just seems like, my God, why didn't we hear about this before?
It's a strange and sort of riveting book. I read right through it, and it doesn't quite come to a sort of satisfactory conclusion about what this did for her exactly. It's a survival story, and if part of it is fantasy and part of it is reality, I guess at this point it doesn't make much difference, because she's incorporated it as her story. And, you know, I think they're probably, I mean, we know there's a lot of kids that are thrown out, you know, into the streets. And she was a street kid who got into a lot of trouble. And I can believe that the monkeys, that she learned how to eat from the monkeys, that she learned from the to eat what fell out of their hands at the bottom of these trees and survived on nuts and fruits for a while. I can believe that. I don't know about 5 years of that, but
it's almost the opposite of what we were talking about in Project Nim, in the sense of she's going into their world.
Yes.
And what she learns and is able to survive and very much has love and respect for those animals to this day.
Yes, she does.
And man, can this woman in her 60s, I believe, climb a tree.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is very cool.
I mean, the feral child thing is a great sort of parallel to the monkeys, and it is the chimps, it is the reverse.
Yeah.
And I think that each group of scientists was sort of studying that feral child work around these language studies, especially.
When you think about our relationship, it's one of the things that came out of your book, it's one of the things that came out of the documentary about our relationship to nature. Wild captivity research, and we've been around this for a fairly long time, and it seems like we don't quite have it right yet. Well, I guess I end by asking you, where does your optimism lie that we will someday get it right? If you indeed.
Yeah, is there any optimism? Let's start with that question.
If you indeed agree with my theory.
I do agree with your theory, and I do think there is some optimism because I think there's a whole younger generation that's faced with inheriting a system of research which just doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work for the animals. And when it doesn't work for the animals, it usually doesn't work for the people either. The best individuals who are working with the sanctuary animals all came from the labs and said, no more. I want to make their lives right now. Mm. And that's an interesting phenomenon because they're very knowledgeable about the animals. And the sanctuary movement, I think we all have to support the sanctuary movement and look at its needs and make sure there's enough room to take in all these animals that are coming out of research.
And then and see that their lives are, the rest of their lives.
They deserve it. You know, they deserve a bit of free time after years in the service of science.
Hmm. Elizabeth Hess is the author of the book Nim Chimpsky, which is out and still available in paperback from Bantam, I believe. Is that correct? Yes. If you haven't seen the documentary Project Nim, it is it's available. It's a BBC film. It's available in video. It's also available in HBO, and it's just a wonderful documentary that was based on your book. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You.
Really, Adam.
My
a lot
pleasure.
To the program. I thank you.